Yo, 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 Thought Warriors. What is up? Power Learning is on. It's I, Van Lathan Jr.
And it's me, Rachel Lynn Lindsay.
We hung out yesterday.
We did. The Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Nice, simple party.
Like a little Super Bowl situation. Yeah, went over there. Super Bowl. We'll talk about the Super Bowl a little bit later. But I was over there and I want to say one thing. I want to say free Copper.
Okay, Copper was fine. He did not have the muzzle on. We didn't do that. He was out here with all the other dogs. What are you talking about?
We're going to talk about the Super Bowl and all the things that happened around it later. But when I say free Copper, it's like, this is what I want to see for Copper.
Okay, tell me.
I walk in, Copper barks at me. I know he's going to bark because it's his house. You know what I mean? It's his house, man. It's his house. You guys are like, no, Copper, no. No, Copper, no. And I'm like, I'm thinking to myself, it's like, you know, Van, of course he knows me. He knows me by scent. He knew me before I even hit the door. What I want is the next time I come over, I want nothing said towards Copper. Like, it's not on my account. Not on my account. If you guys want to raise your kid however you want. But if Copper nips me, if Copper barks at me, that's Copper's crib. I keep telling y'all, don't weigh him down with all these expectations because I'm there. Don't do it on my account.
I've seen me open the door and him literally charge at people. You have to let me say, hold on, hold him, and then let me say, okay, acknowledge him. And then you touch him. That prevents a charge or a bite.
So this is my thing.
I know my child.
This is my thing. Let him get it off. You come into his house. Copper's been through so much. You know what I mean?
What are you talking about?
He was a street dog.
He was.
You think that he wants somebody coming in off the streets trying to take what he got? And by the way, no one plays with Bozeman better than Copper. Bozeman cannot control himself. It's just not going to happen. Bozeman's up, like, knocking shit over. Brian's like, just looking around, like, what's going on? Bozeman's knocking shit over everywhere. And Copper's just like, well, let me chill. This big crazy nigga. He looks at Bozeman like a child. It's like, sit down, son. They play well together as cousins.
They do. They play well together. They do. Browning, on the other hand, got at Bozeman. He scared Bozeman.
Yeah, Bozeman's not here for the conflict. It's a burden. I mean, Bozeman's not here for the conflict. Bozeman's here to like have a good time, you know?
Yeah, Brownie wouldn't have it.
Yeah,
he's
Brownie
a monster.
Brownie's brave, you know? Brownie's brave.
Y'all, there was a moment during the watch party where I caught Van just staring at Brownie. He got lost in Brownie. I watched you for a good 45 seconds. You were just staring at Brownie. And then you go, Brownie's really cute.
Yeah, Brownie's a cute dog.
I was like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah, Brownie's a cute dog. I looked at Brownie. Brownie's a little cute dog. Brownie's got a little personality. Brownie's a cute pup. I like dogs. Okay? I love dogs. I love Brownie. So yesterday was your first day back in LA because you went to the Super Bowl situation. How was it?
It was great. I had so much fun. My voice, it's not even that bad. You know how my voice can get. Mm-hmm. But it was a good weekend. Hit the dinners, hit the parties, did a little networking, did one thing work-wise. I was in and out. A lot of people say, why don't you stay for the Super Bowl? I think that's kind of the deal with me and Brian, because this is a tradition for me to go, because I met Katie at Super Bowl, so we always hang out together. I go out, have a good time, but the deal is I come back and I watch the Super Bowl every year with Brian. I don't stay, because Brian would be feel a certain way if he didn't get to go to the Super Bowl, and I get that. He don't want to do all the other stuff. So I come home and we watch it together every year.
So no matter, because see, this year it's easy because the Super Bowl was in Arizona. It's like an hour flight. But like, let's say the Super Bowl would have been in Miami. So then you would have gone to all of this stuff and then flown out Like,
I actually did do that. So we lived in Miami when the Super Bowl was in Miami. But Brian came to most of the stuff with me. We went together to all the parties. And the day of the Super Bowl, I flew back. I actually left Brian that time because I had to work or something. I was still freelancing in LA and there was something I had to do in LA. So I left and I still caught the Super Bowl.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Maybe I made it at halftime. Whatever it was, I saw it. I saw Shakira and J-Lo. I think I only missed the first quarter.
Shakira. I like different songs. You know what I like? I like the Lady Gaga era.
You know? So her era is over?
Yeah, like the way I'm talking about. I'm talking about Alejandro, Poker Face, you know what I mean? Everybody name their favorite Lady Gaga song. What's your favorite Lady Gaga song?
I really like You and I.
I don't know that song.
Okay.
I don't know it.
The telephone song she does with Beyonce. Song.
That's a good, she has telephone and then she has, I think Beyonce has like video phone. It's two different phones. And like, I think I like Alejandro. I just love that song.
Really?
Donnie, yeah, I don't know why. Donnie, what's your favorite Lady Gaga song? Lady Gaga's era was epic.
Yeah, agreed. Mine is Poker Face, but Poker it's a specific one. The one where she's, I like the regular one, but I like one where she's playing on the piano. And it's like an MTV clip.
Yeah,
version.
Like she plays it staccato. Mm-hmm, I think I know what you're talking about at the beginning.
Yeah, dun, it's dun, really
dun,
good.
Dun, dun, dun.
Exactly. Yeah.
Ashley, what about yours?
I like Mary the Night. Like she had.
Thank God somebody chose a different song. I mean, they're over here naming her top three. I was like, please, somebody pick a different song.
Yeah, it was like a big like music video on MTV, like during like the MTV Video Awards a long time ago. And it was like 12 minutes long and it was like a big thing. It was great.
Yeah, she's dope. I remember when they took Poker Face and they made it into that song with Kanye. You know that song with Kanye Common?
Oh, with Kid Cudi?
Yeah.
My Poker Face.
I'd never heard of taking a song
Born
that new and
old
chopping
enough.
The Think about that. Born
I
in
really
88.
Like that song.
How old is that? Old enough. Like now, old born enough. In 88, you old. Like a lot of time has passed. You know what I mean? Yeah, anyway.
I love that song. Forgot
Donnie, did you watch the Super Bowl yesterday?
I did. It was entertaining until the end.
You didn't like it at the end. You don't like when the refs
fizzled out, yeah.
The refs make accurate calls, you know. Enjoy that.
Wait, everybody, who thinks the call was fair?
So it's an accurate call. There's no doubt about it.
No. Not holding. His hand was just there.
Okay, see? Donnie okay.
So can
Donnie
I be honest with you guys?
Well, you know the player yeah. admitted,
so
Donnie, that
get
he
the
held
fuck
him.
Off. The guy said that he helped. He said, I grabbed him. I think they're going to. He said it. It's an accurate call.
The question
call.
Becomes, do they normally call that? Because sometimes they let them go. I guess that's dependent on the ref.
If
some refs let
it
go, some refs don't.
That's fine. All that matters to me is that it's the rule infraction. Because I tell you one thing. Is that if they don't call it, and then it's like, oh, he was grabbing his jersey. Then after the game, he said, I grabbed his jersey. Is it a shitty way for the game to end? Sure, it is.
Unless the Chiefs won. If they didn't call it, and the Chiefs still won, nobody would talk about it.
Are we going to get to the Super Bowl in a second? I have to say something real. Number one, we have... We have Peniel Joseph coming up. We give you guys 40 minutes of Peniel Joseph. And we talk about everything. We talk about women's place in civil rights. We talk about DEI in Texas and them trying to do away with it. We give you a Black History Month check-in with one of the smartest men in all of America, Peniel Joseph.
Yes. Good conversation.
Before we get to anything, we have to talk about something. We lost an absolute legend, Trigoy the Dove, one of the founding members of De La Soul. He died Sunday at 54. Cause of death has not been revealed, but he'd been open about his diagnosis of congestive heart failure. Okay. For a lot of you younger kids, you might not understand the importance of De La Soul. But there was this brilliant, amazing, beautiful time and maybe it still exists and I'm too out of the loop to know, when rap was this fabric interwoven with all of these different threads, where there were gangsters from the West, where they were slick-talking niggas from the South, where they were purists from the East. But there's also this brilliant, amazing, jazzy, Afrocentric, offbeat, off-kilter group of guys called the Native Tongue Family. Native Tongue Family, Tribe Called Quest, Jungle Brothers, De La Soul, all of them making some of the most introspective, brave, beautiful, poetic, and enduring hip-hop music ever. And that's what De La Soul represents. De La Soul represents just a purity and a sincerity of artistic expression that you rarely see in any sort of musical genre. And they did it, and they became legends for it. And this is the important reason why we have to make sure that we treat our pioneers and our legends and our building blocks, our foundation in a certain way. For those of you who don't know, De La Soul's music for a long time due to contract disputes and other sort of red tape musical issues was not available on streaming services. It is now about to become available. So there's going to be an entire generation of people who are going to be reacquainted and for the first time acquainted with the brilliance of De La Soul. And this brother, who's only 54 years old, didn't get a chance to see that. Now, he got a chance to see all kinds of other things. For the people that know, that care, they were celebrated the way that they were supposed to. But when we're talking about the people that made a way, that plowed a way for hip-hop to be what it is right now, the reason why it's important to care about them is because you want brothers like this to be able to smell those flowers. And all of the time that is wasted in these seemingly intractable disputes where they're fighting for their artistic lives and the right to monetize the genius that they put out there, it's wasted time. And we don't know how long they're going to be with us. We just have no clue how long they're going to be with us. So it was doubly gutting to me that this happened just before there was going to be a resurgence and a renaissance of De La Soul. I grew up on, and I grew up on the first incarnation of D-Nice when he was a rapper. I grew up on BDP. I grew up on guys like Kwame, Redhead Kingpin, you know what I mean, Chubb Rock, all of these other guys that you can consider to be the dudes in hip hop that were, you know, leaders of the new school. All of those guys, like, I grew up on all of this type of rock. Obviously, the Tribe Called Quest, all of these guys, right? Those guys are important, man. They matter. They're, like, really, really integral to everything that was going on. They changed it up. They flowed different. They dressed different. For a kid like myself who wasn't slanging no keys or getting no money off the street, didn't have no holes on the stroll, it mattered. It was important to me. It was fucking important to me. So I hope that everyone understands the genius of De La Soul. My heart goes out to the surviving group members. My heart goes out to everybody in hip-hop that's been affected by this. But just like Dilla, you know what I mean? Just like countless others, this one was one that really hurt. Mm. It really hurt.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really going to add too much to that because what you just said is beautiful and you're obviously way more acquainted with De La Soul's music than I am. I did just interview Paz though, and yeah, he performed at the Grammys in the hip hop celebration. So if you haven't already, that's something that put them back out too, because he was out there representing for De La Soul. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm not as familiar. So what you said was beautiful, and that it's, I'll say this, for people who consume hip hop, I think what highlights even more of what you just said is that you look at it, and I'm throwing myself in this, you look at it for what it is right now and not necessarily the originators of it. You know, I'm familiar with names, I'm familiar with certain songs, but not necessarily the history, not necessarily the struggle of the music and the artistry of it. So I think that what you said is so encouraging for people who do consume it to understand it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You're right. All right. I'm going to take a break. On the other side of this, we're going to come back. Talk a little bit about the Super Bowl.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
Okay, Rachel, your thoughts on the Super Bowl?
I thought it was a great Super Bowl. All people from like myself who don't have an allegiance to either team just wanted to see a good game and a good halftime performance, which we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. That's all I wanted. This was especially the first half. It was an exciting game. There was the offense was killing it. It was a back and forth, back and forth. I was personally rooting for Jalen Hurts, so it was really great to see him do his thing.
He fumbled. Cost him the game.
It was really great to see him do his thing. His fumble did not cost him the game. The refs missing the call. I'm just kidding.
Oh, I mean, Jalen Hurts played a fantastic game.
Exactly. An amazing game. And he set a historic record.
But
okay. Stop being negative. You asking me my thoughts? You didn't hear me say, no, it was the refs for call. I'm joking. Yeah. Anyways, I enjoyed this game, enjoyed watching it. It was everything that I wanted it to be. And it was great to see two black quarterbacks thrive on football's biggest stage. I enjoyed it. I was entertained. It's what I wanted to see, even though it's not necessarily the outcome that I wanted at the end of the day. What did you think?
I thought a couple of things. I thought, number one, I couldn't help but feel a little bit like an old Uncle Tom, you know, watching the game.
Oh.
Yeah. Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reid.
You watch football.
Not really. I'll be honest with you. I don't really watch. Look, I watch too much of it. I shouldn't be watching as much of it. I just want everybody to know we're all talking about the football. We're all complicit in one of the greatest misjustices in American sports history. It's just a fact.
Don't go down a Colin Kaepernick hole.
I'm not going to go. What do you mean it's not Colin Kaepernick hole? It's a Colin Kaepernick shooting star as a comment. I just want everybody to know this. This is what I want everybody to know. Everybody had a great time. We poured hundreds of millions of dollars of commerce. I did it as well. We all did it. We all had a great time. There's a cost. That's all I want people to know. There's a cost. And for Black people, especially, we got to remember, there's a cost. That's all. Okay, so I have to say that.
So are we watching it together next year?
Next year? So I'm going to be honest with you. I'm working my ass off right now to try to change the fate of Colin Kaepernick and doing everything that I can do. At some point, I'm going to have to punt on the NFL. It's going to be hard. But at some point, I'm going to have to punt on the NFL.
Between that means you can't play the game either.
What game? Madden?
Yeah, you can't play the game either.
I can't play any Madden.
No. That's football.
I don't know, man.
That contributes.
Can I tell you something, though? Aha, just in time. You know what they have coming back out? NCAA football game. They have that coming out. And I love that just as much.
Well,
I can make the turn to, but I'm going to be real with you, man. It's going to be hard to give up on some Madden. But we'll see. Because I use Madden to cope with life. but we'll see.
Find a new sport.
Don't talk to me like this, Rachel.
I'm just trying to hold you to your word.
I need to be, they got Deshaun Watson in the league. They got Watson in the league. 60 women nutted on them all. However, Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reid, just for standing up for black people, can't be in the league. Deshaun Watson legit crazy. I'm sorry. I don't give a fuck what y'all say. The nigga's nuts.
It's wild that he got to come back this season. That's wild to me.
38-35. Donnie put the game box score down here. I don't know why we're not going to go through.
He did.
I put a link to it just in case you wanted to.
Thank you for being thorough, Donnie.
Get to what people were talking about. Rihanna's halftime performance is what we're talking about. Some people were mad at Riri because Riri was a staunch supporter of the movement back when it was very fashionable to be a staunch supporter. Things have changed, and now Riri is doing the halftime show. Whatever, Rihanna can do no wrong. I love her. However, we should all be concerned. It should be top of mind. Anyway, what did you think about the halftime performance, Rachel?
Thought it was great. Okay.
Okay.
I really thought it was great. I was excited to see Rihanna on stage.
Yeah.
She could have stood there with the microphone, not moved her head, and I would have been excited just to see her in all her glory at the halftime show. Being Rihanna. That's it. So for me, you know, we watched it in a room full of people. It was me, Van, Kalika, and Brian. And the dogs. And I would say about 10 seconds in, we all kind of started to look at each other. Like, who wants to be the first one to say it? Yeah. Who wants to be the first one to ask the question? We immediately started asking ourselves, is Rihanna pregnant?
Y'all started asking. I didn't ask.
What was the first thing I said? I said, I do not believe that it is fair to ever speculate that. Because you were looking on Twitter and you were like, Twitter is going off.
I pray to God she is. What people were saying.
Show.
I will never forget Joe Knox, who was my cousin's dad, my grandmother's sister's husband, one day saw my mom in the grocery store and asked my mother if she was with child when my mother was not pregnant. And my mom was pissed and hurt. I never speculate on whether or not a lady's pregnant or not. You know what I mean?
More people need to follow suit. I was not. So it was like, y'all, she could not be. So I just couldn't believe how everybody was talking about it without knowing. And because it's not like we've seen Rihanna that much in the public eye. We're seeing her a lot this week because we knew she was performing. She's been doing press for it. But she's also been very covered up. If you look, she's been very covered up. Anyways, I was shocked. And I said, I pray she's pregnant because I cannot imagine. And Rihanna doesn't seem to be bothered by anything. But I would have hated for people to be speculating in that way. And she wasn't.
Uh-huh.
But she is. And it's been confirmed. Yeah. And that's beautiful. And I think that's great. And I think that adds to how historic, or that it was historic. It's the first time that any halftime performer has performed while they were carrying a child, while they were pregnant.
Yeah.
I think that made it even better. It was beautiful that she gave it to us in a very subtle way. She wasn't out loud with it. You know, she didn't drop a microphone at the end of her performance and then reveal.
Wow.
I'm kidding. I actually loved when she did that. I'm kidding. I'm just messing Jesus with y'all because y'all get so mad at me. I'm kidding. I actually loved when Beyonce did that with Love on
That's
Top.
Going
I
on
loved
Instagram.
That performance.
I'm telling you.
No.
I'm putting it on the gram. You every time you
don't
come
clip
at Beyonce.
Me. Don't clip me out though when I say I'm kidding. Don't clip me out. Anyways, I love that she did it in a subtle way. And it was genius to me because it had everybody talking. The game had started and we were still trying to figure out if Rihanna was with child. It was a genius moment. She had a vibe. I think a lot of people wanted her to be over the top. Rihanna is a vibe. There is an energy about Rihanna. And she was giving us all of that in the performance. I loved it.
The performance itself, to me, went from being a performance that was sort of unremarkable to one that was insanely remarkable. And that's just the way this goes. I keep telling people this. It's like people go, well, it was whatever, whatever. The performance was whatever, whatever. But once you know the context behind it, it becomes one of the most amazing performances ever, right? Because think about it. Right now, if I told you Giannis had a game where he went out and he was 7 of 27 from the field, right? And he had, I don't know, 22 points, you know, and made a bunch of free throws and, you know, whatever. And just like, Giannis had a bad game. But if I told you that he had like a torn labrum or something like that while he was doing all of that and gutted out a victory for his team, even though he shot poorly, made it to the line a bunch of times, played defense, it changes the perspective of the performance. To me, for her to be up there, for her to be way up high like that, and to do all of this stuff while with child, amazing. It's amazing. It was fantastic to see her. It shows the commitment that she has to her fans and to everything else, that she got up and gave a performance, you know what I mean, while she was pregnant. It was Rihanna, so you still have fun watching her. At first, it seemed like, oh, she isn't really dancing that hard. She isn't really doing whatever, and you're wondering if she's been gone. But you realize after that she's pregnant, and it changes the context of the performance in a really good way and makes it one of the most meaningful Super Bowl performances of all time. It's not the best Super Bowl performance of all time, but it's one of the most remarkable and meaningful Super Bowl performances of all time because it's the first time anybody ever performed up there with a baby in their stomach. God damn it.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Super Bowl commercial time. I have a soapbox.
Go for it, because you were way more into it than I was.
We were talking about this yesterday, right? I have a soapbox about Super Bowl commercials. The best commercial was the Farmer's Dog commercial with the dog, his master, pulling on the heartstrings. Actually, as Rachel and Kalika, if I should get some Farmer's Dog stuff after. Rachel's like, don't get the Farmer's Dog. Okay, Rachel said that Farmer's Dog.
I have an experience, and I have other friends that have used it that have experience.
It's fine. I don't know. Anything that'll keep my little Wozily Wabbit around longer, I'll do it. That Farmer's Dog commercial was great. The Tubi commercial was great.
Yeah, it was good.
Where they took over your TV. Tubi commercial was great. Other than that, and the Bunny commercial was great, where the other Tubi commercial where they threw everybody down the rabbit holes.
Yeah.
Other than that, most of the commercials sucked ass, and I'll tell you why. We went from this time, back in my day, where we had all kinds of amazing commercials. We had the Clydesdales. We had the Bud Bowl. We had Spuds McKenzie. We had the Waza. We had all kinds of different commercials that people did. We had Doritos commercial, all of that stuff, right? Basically, what we have now with the Super Bowl commercials is 150 different celebrities hawking shit or doing shit from movies from the 80s and the 90s. It's, to me, whack as fuck and indicative of where society is. The lowest sort of effort, right? Rather than give you a new movie that you can go see, they give you some kind of IP regurgitation of something that came out 15, 20, 30 years ago. Rather than actually give you like a commercial that's about something that's kind of cool, that sparks like a cultural phenomenon, fuck it. Let's give Adam Driver $10 million and just let him hawk something. Let's put Will Ferrell in something. Let's put Kevin Hart in something. It's just lazy and whack and no creativity. We're in the era of mid. It's the era of mid. Everything is mid. You get all excited for all of this stuff, and at the end of the day, it's fucking mid. It's just okay. The game was going to be a great game. We're going to see Jalen Hurts with a chance to drive the field to tie or go ahead in the game, depending on what happened. You know what happened? Something that happened, just make it mid. Just make it a little mid. I don't know. I wasn't feeling the Super Bowl commercials. Rachel, what about yourself?
No, I mean, we discussed it. I, too, was like, if I see one more celebrity at this point. Surprisingly, the celebrity commercial that I liked the most was the Dunkin' Donuts commercial. I thought that was cute with Ben Affleck and J-Lo, especially because he's a super fan of Dunkin' Donuts. So I understood the attachment to it. But other than that, it was almost like a Marvel movie. At this point, if you're not in a Marvel, all celebrities want to be in Marvel movies. It's the new thing. Everybody's like, I want to be in a Marvel movie. Sure. One thing. It's like a bucket list thing on their career. Because Marvel is the hottest thing and they have such a huge fan base. And it's huge for you to get into that world. That's what I'm feeling like with Super Bowl commercials at this point. I mean, who are you if you don't get a Super Bowl commercial? That's what it felt like. And it's going to be worse next year. It's going to be worse. You know what? We talked about this, but after going through the whole game, it made me miss the crypto commercials where there was just silence and there was a QR code. There was a QR code. Crypto was a celebrity last year.
And then the whole game. Is also like, oh, the whole game is like, oh, here's who's in the crowd. Here's Paul McCartney. Who gives a fuck?
They do
Paul
that McCartney every time.
I don't give a fuck. I'm sick of it. I'm here it is. Hypocrisy time, hypocrite time. It's time for the ex-TMZ guy to say that this entire celebrity culture thing, which we'll be covering a little bit later on this podcast as well, there's a limit, guys. There's a limit to where it starts to just get whacker and whacker. And to me, just watching the commercials used to be dope. You know what I mean? They used to be super awesome. And now, that's why the Farmer's Dog commercial was the best commercial. It was a real commercial about a real pup. You know what I mean? About a real pup.
I actually like to see who's at the game.
Why? Why do you care about who went to the game?
It's just interesting to me. Like I'm not even a big person who's into celebrity like that. You know, I'm not name dropping my friends every chance I get on this podcast. That's not me. The ding rule exists for you, but I like to see who's there. I'm like, oh, that's so-and-so. And they brought their kid. Oh, they brought their wife. Oh, that was cute. I don't know. I like to see it. I'm always interested.
Do you know what I really don't like about it? What I don't like about seeing all the famous people at the game is that I just think it just shows me that regular people can't go to the game. Yeah. It's like, because like you're watching the game, yeah. Right? It's Paul McCartney, it's Elon Musk and Rupert Murdoch. Fucking Pearl, right? It's Elon Musk, Rupert Murdoch, all of these far people that, Jay-Z's here and Wick Walking. Oh, everybody having a fun time. Beyonce, you know, and all of this stuff is going on. And I'm thinking, live in a place where like a regular person can't go to the Super Bowl. And I'm not sure if we should live, you know what? I would like a world where a regular person would be able to go to the Super Bowl and have fun at the Super Bowl. And it's a memory for some kids somewhere that will be able to go to the Super Bowl with their family. Maybe it would cost a lot of money, but at least it's something that's aspirationally affordable. But in the way that we're living now, the Super Bowl is something for the NFL, and it's only for famous and rich people. It's just, I don't like that.
It's always been that way.
That's not true.
It hasn't always been expensive to go to the Super Bowl.
It's maybe been expensive, but it hasn't always been. Like, a lot of these things are changing like this. Like, I go back right now. I challenge everybody to do something right now. Go watch an NBA slam dunk contest on the fucking, on YouTube. Go watch an NBA slam dunk contest from 1995 or 1996. And then watch it now. Now. I will say the slam dunk contest audience is better, like, for some reasons, because there's more Black people at the slam dunk contest. All-Star Weekend has changed. But also, you just see more, like, families there. Like, you just see more, like, people there. They're like, but now when you look at the game, you see all this stuff, it's like, oh, shit, J. Cole about to come out and dunk. That's cool. I don't know, man.
You know what, though? I guess for me, I never even thought I would be Super Bowl adjacent. So as a consumer of football, I don't know if I ever desired to go. I mean, well, you know, Cowboys, I guess, back in the day. But I thought it was cool. It was this big, bigger than life thing. And I never really looked at it as I'll be able to go. I just love to watch it because for me, it was like, wow, it's the Super Bowl. It's this fantasy. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm like sitting at home mad because as a civilian, I can't afford to go to the Super Bowl. It's just so cool to watch. It was just this bigger than life thing. Now that I'm an adult, it's not as big of a deal. Do you know what I mean when I say that?
I don't know.
I feel like you could do that with so many big things. The NBA Finals, Super Bowl, college national championship.
But to me, it's like, it's a reminder of sort of, like you and I could easily go to the Super Bowl, right? Like it's.
That's expensive.
Rachel, if you don't want to go to the Super Bowl, I could have made a couple calls and we could have gone to the Super Bowl. No fucking problem. Okay,
Donnie.
Like it's facts. I'm just. It's facts.
I'm not saying it's not.
Like it's facts. What I'm saying is that it's just to me, and maybe it's just the way that it happens. It's just becoming a reminder of the gross difference in inequality. I don't know.
You turn on the TV, it's everywhere. I get what you're saying. You're not wrong. Yeah. It's just it's everywhere.
I'm doing too much. Vance doing too much. Okay. I want to play this by Chris Berman real quick. I don't know if you saw this. Chris Berman had a message for everyone during NFL primetime. Donnie, run the audio. It's one of the most important messages ever. He made an observation, and I think everyone should hear it.
Also, of course, two African-American quarterbacks starting against each other in the Super Bowl for the first time. Fittingly, February 12th is Abe Lincoln's birthday. Here we go with the highlights.
Okay.
Who was sitting at the table with him?
I believe it was Steve Young.
Was it Booger?
And Booger. I think Booger was there. Yeah. Okay. This is not like a big... It's not like... He said two niggas are starting the Super Bowl or something like that. But this is the type of shit that I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Nigga don't give a fuck about no Abe Lincoln. This is a deeper, it's like fittingly on Abe Lincoln's birthday. Let me tell you, for anyone that might be listening and wonders, why is that irking to Van? Because it gets on my fucking nerves because in some way it's saying, that Abe Lincoln, a white guy, is the one that is responsible for the advancement. And
that's exactly what it's saying.
Guys, this is the problem. It's not, it's just like, you know, man, I don't want to like not act like the Emancipation Proclamation isn't important. I don't want to act like that's not a big deal. Right. But if you know your history and context, to just say on Abe Lincoln's birthday, the nigga who freed the slaves, look at these two blacks play football. It's odd. It's off-putting. It's weird. And it's like there's this kind of underlying subtext. It's like, yeah, you know, you walk around, you see a black guy do something. Hey, shout out Abe Lincoln. No, not shout out Abe. Shout out Abe. I'm sorry. I'm like, for real, Chris? And he's old. He probably thought he was being real as shit. Yo, man. Abe Lincoln's birthday. Yeah. Two black guys. He probably was doing just, y'all, white people. I promise, man.
No.
It's gravy. Just relax. Y'all got to relax, man.
But this is why it rubbed me the wrong way. Like, I laugh. But one, it's just such BS. It's as if not you. Yes, that is Abraham Lincoln's birthday. But you're saying it almost as if we should be thankful. You know, it's historic for this. And fittingly, it's this appropriately that it's his birthday because black people should forever be thankful to Abraham Lincoln, which is not historically accurate, which highlights a deeper issue about why, you know, they're trying to change education and not allow certain things to be taught in school. It's because Chris Berman is of the generation where he was taught, and we were taught this in school too, that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, and we praised him, or we were supposed to praise him and look at him as some sort of deity for doing that to us as Black people, when the reality is Lincoln didn't even believe that Black people should have the same rights as white people. Okay, so like that's the kind of history we need to be talking about if you dive deeper into it. So that's why this irked me, because that's not actually how we should be perceiving Abraham Lincoln.
Chris Berman is younger than I thought he was. He's 67. Okay, so he's 60.
How old did you think he was?
I thought Chris Berman was in his 70s for sure, man.
Okay,
I thought Chris Berman was in his 70s for sure. So Chris Berman is younger than I thought he was. Okay. All right. So here's my thing with this. I understand that. The frustrating thing is that in all of the time that Chris Berman has been doing this thing and all the time Chris Berman has been on television, he's been a household name, that there's been no evolution of his thought. That's the scary thing. The scary part of it is not what you were taught. Okay. The scary part of it is what you haven't learned since. And so for me,
yes.
Like someone who's kind of, you know, obsessed with like decoding things, and probably it's a coping mechanism. It's not something, it's like I do it because I have an anxiety disorder. It's like, whatever. I always need something running through my brain. But just to think that it's 2023 and we're still back to the shout out to Abe Lincoln situation. That's like a 1975, 1970, at best, 1985 framework, you know? And it's
I was taught in school about it's not the glory of Abraham Lincoln.
Worst thing in the world to say, but it's just so fucking odd in the times that we live in today.
That's not odd. He's a 67-year-old white man.
No. It's not odd. I know what you mean. But I'm saying
it's fitting. To use a word from Chris Berman, it is very fitting for him. It's not shocking to hear him say that. It just highlights the issues that we have in this country. And as you pointed out, that there's no desire to be better.
Chris Berman's, it's just funny. So both, but Chris Berman talking about Black quarterbacks. Oh my God, Chrissy Berman. It's all great. All right, let's take a break.
He did it on purpose.
He wanted to say it.
He wanted to say it so bad. He's like, enough of this Black quarterback talk. That's literally, you cannot tell me anything different. He was like, I am sick of talking about how this game is about historic Black quarterbacks. Y'all done brought Doug Williams out here. Y'all done brought Doug Williams out here. Let me just let y'all know, just in case y'all forgot, Abe Lincoln. That is exactly what he said. Like, I ran between all those lines.
You feel like Chris Berman felt like niggas was getting too much credit and he wanted to throw it back to old Honest Abe.
Yes. That's what you're saying. Fittingly, come on, fittingly is a strong word. And he ended it on that. He wanted to get that in. It was a mic drop moment for him. I'm sorry, I can keep going. This has bothered me.
All right, let's take a break. We're going to give you Dr. Neil Joseph on the other side of this.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
You guys, we told you we'd bring them back. during Black History Month, Dr. Peniel Joseph, Peniel E. Joseph, of course, he's a scholar, teacher, a public voice on race issues, especially the history of the Black Power movement. Joint professorship appointment at the LBJ School of Public Affairs and the History Department at the University of Texas Austin.
Ooh. Don't be a hater.
Ooh. As we told you guys to pick up the sword and the shield, the revolutionary lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. We told you guys to pick up the third Reconstruction. You should also pick up Stokely. If you look back right here, Stokely, you'll see right there. Wait until the midnight hour. You'll see right there. The sword and the shield. You'll see right there. And other books that Dr. Joseph told me to read. The third Reconstruction, you'll see all right here. All right
here. Are you at home, Ben, or is that your home office, or is that your?
I'm actually at your house. This is your bookshelf. If you turn around, I'm at home. Yeah, look at Dr. Joseph's bookshelf. So many books.
There's a lot.
You had something to say when you came on about what's going on in Texas. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, Texas is under attack. You know, people talk about DeSantis in Florida, but the great state of Texas is under attack. Greg Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, not only are they trying to ban the teaching of Black history in K-12 education, but they're trying to ban the teaching of diversity, equity, inclusion in all state agencies, right? And when we think about DEI, I actually am associate dean for DEI at the LBJ school. That's really the whole idea of bringing equity to the curriculum, the culture, the community, and the composition of state agencies, higher ed. It means bringing Black and brown, queer, just folks who've been marginalized to the table. And of course, they're all qualified, right? We never bring people to the table. It's like what you all do. You're not trying to say, hey, somebody who can't do it, we're suddenly giving them access. We're saying people who are qualified for whatever it is they want to do, but who aren't just white, male, straight, who've dominated everything since the birth of the country. So they're trying to ban that in Texas. They're trying to ban tenure. They're introducing a bunch of new bills. So this is, you know, they're trying to turn Texas into Florida. And it's really dramatically bad. And the basis of this is basically, anti-Blackness. Soledad O'Brien just tweeted the idea when Marjorie Taylor Greene says she could have used no wokeness at the Super Bowl. That wokeness is just at now just a phrase for not just Black, but probably a racial slur, as white supremacists say it, right? So when they say it was too woke, they're basically calling us the N-word. Yeah. That's where we're at. Mm-hmm. You know, so when people say the anti-woke bills, or DeSantis has the woke, stop woke act, and that's where we are. So this Black History Month, we have to understand like what our priorities are, especially the theme is resistance. But like in Texas, you know, Rachel, you know, Texas is a great state and there are people struggling for Black freedom and citizenship and dignity, and for Hispanic folks and Asian folks and queer folks and poor white folks in the state. But there's a whole other history of Texas that's a really rugged, rough history. And that's the history that kept us out of UT. UT was founded in 1883 and it's founded as a segregated school. And the reason why that should be really important for us is that that's founded only 18 years after the end of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So UT should not have been a racially segregated school. We had just fought a Civil War where over 700,000 people died. So UT would not be racially segregated, but it still was. So we have a hard history, and this Black History Month, it's still playing out here in Texas.
Yeah, you mentioned Texas being a great state, but it seems that the other side of Texas is what's louder than anything else. You know, we talk about DeSantis and Abbott on this podcast quite a bit, and I swear they're in a competition of who can be more outrageous, racist. You know, it's wild how these two are going head to head. And if Florida does it, you very well know that other red states, Texas being included, are going to do the same thing. This state representative, Carl Tepper, who filed this bill. He said that DEI doesn't stand for diversity, equality, and inclusion, that it stands for division, inequity, and indoctrination. All I was going to say is, yes, please speak on that. And then also, based on how we've seen other things go through, you know, Congress in Texas, see things get passed, see things move forward. How likely do you think that this is going to be another thing that they are successful on with their agenda?
Well, because Texas has been gerrymandered, racially gerrymandered for decades and decades. Remember, Texas is the home of the all-white primary that was challenged in the Supreme Court 1927, and it was an all-white Democratic Party. So we have to remember the parties flipped. The contemporary Republican Party is actually the old Democratic Party, which is the Dixiecrat Party and the party of white supremacy. That's what a lot of people kind of don't understand that, but that's what happened starting in the late 60s.
What was the gist of that flip? Tell them, Dr. Joseph.
The flip was done because of civil rights. Lyndon Johnson said after he passed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, we've lost the South for a generation. But it was for more than just a generation. The racist white South went and incorporated and took over the entire Republican Party. That's what they did. And it wasn't just MAGA. It is old Dixiecrats who, these are the people who they killed Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman in Mississippi in 1964. They murdered Emmett Till in 1955. You know, when they were looking for Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman in Mississippi, they dragged several rivers for 2 months, and they came up with 8 torsos and heads and limbs of Black people who had been lynched and placed in rivers in Mississippi. True story. This is 1964. They finally found the bodies of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, 2 white, 1 Black, on August 4th, 1964 in Mississippi in an earthen dam. That's where they found it, right? And so, you know, this is the history that we should be talking about, but it's also, you know, we talk about resistance. We, you know, we should be angry. We should be angry. I saw, Van, your interview with Acho, and that's one of the books, the legendary interview. But we should be angry. And I think that, you know, even as, you know, some folks might not be feel so connected to this history that they feel they're sort of above it and can be really cool about it. But this is our history, and this is our people being attacked and being killed. And we should be angry. We should certainly organize that, but we should be mad. We should be mad and we should be upset about this. So I understand, and we should feel passionate that this is not the kind of world we want to live in. But we have to understand that what's going on now is exactly what was going on in the 1860s and 1870s and 1880s. For a second, forget the 1960s, forget King, forget all the stuff you see in the media. In the 1860s, 70s, and 80s, including right in Texas, I've got Merle Petrie has a great book on Black leadership, which is really just about Black Reconstruction in Texas, who's Merle Petrie, great historian at Texas Southern University, African-American woman, M-E-R-L-E, last name is P-I-T-R-E. These are the people who do the root work. She has a great history book about Texas Southern University, too. So when we talk about HBCUs, Southern, and why it's so important, right? But, you know, this is what was happening to us right after we got voting rights. This is what was happening to us right after we got birthright citizenship. We were being oppressed with these laws and this legislation that said Black citizenship and dignity was reverse discrimination, that it was reverse racism against white people. So this is an important time for us, because everybody who thought to themselves, you grow up and you think to yourself, man, what would I have done in those times, you know, in those times, whether it's the Black Panthers or Martin Luther King Jr., Angela Davis, or Reconstruction, Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln, you're in it. You're in it right now. These are the times. So this is not this high, you know, you can't sit back and say, oh, these other people did it for me and they achieved for me and now I've got it easy. You're in, you know, just an updated, evolved version. They didn't have Twitter. Or now Spoutable with Chris Boozy. They didn't have that.
Shout out Chris.
Yeah, shout out to Chris. They didn't have, higher learning and podcasts. But the forces that we're facing and we're up against, they confronted the same forces of DeSantis and Dan Patrick and Donald Trump and all that we're facing, they confronted.
So I want to ask you about something before I get to the sort of civil rights aspect of our talk. I want to ask you about not a specific case, but an overall idea. So there's a case going on in Colorado right now with Mallory family who relocated from Houston to Colorado. And they are the victims of what they say are is wholesale white terrorism in the neighbors and people in surrounding areas that don't want them to have their farm. They say that the crops are being poisoned, the livestock is being killed, and they are being intimidated. Okay. We talked about this with Hawk Newsom on Monday, on Friday. And it's happy to say that some money has been raised to help Hawk and the rest of the activists go down there to have some of this stuff that they need, but we're going to need more stuff for them.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I want to ask you a question. I talk about it a lot here, but I want maybe if you know to go a little deeper in the history of Black land ownership in America and how that changed to post 1910s, 1915s, 1920s. How did Black people go from owning the most land that they've ever owned in acreage in around 1905, 1906, 1907 to now owning literally the least amount of land that we've ever owned to the point to maybe Paul Allen and a couple of other people, like the top four white landowners in the country, own more land now than all of Black America combined? How does that happen from us having land to not having it? What went down?
Yeah, you know, there's a great, the great book that was a National Book Award finalist, his name is George Floyd, actually does a great history of this through George Floyd's family and the way in which the Floyds, both on his mother and father's side, they had some prosperity and they had some land ownership in North Carolina and other places. And that land was taken away from them. So it's a number of different ways, both I'll say legally and extra legally. And by legally, these are things that should not have been legal, but they were legal because it was against
Black,
right? The extra legal, I mean, is the violence, the terror. There's a great essay in the 1619 Project by Tremaine Lee that
deals fantastic.
And I actually helped edit that essay for the New York Times. So
yeah.
It's fantastic. Tremaine Lee, the legacy chapter, and also the chapter Dispossessed in Dispossession in 1619 Project. So long story short, the way they did it was several things. So one was what they're facing in the case you just talked about in terms of, you know, poisoning livestock, driving people out through terror, maybe burning people out, really just physically intimidating them. Another way of doing it was just simply not acknowledging Black ownership of the land. And this is what we have to understand. When it comes to land and property in the United States, whiteness protects you and your land. Because what it does is it provides a kind of legitimacy and authority in terms of your neighbors. So your neighbors aren't going to really mess with you. Now, there are exceptions to this. The range wars, the Montana, Wyoming wars of the 1860s and 1870s. And that pitted small white capitalists against huge white capitalists who were going to put in the railroad. And they at times even murdered the smaller white capitalists. I just want people to know. So there are exceptions. But for the most part, As the country industrialized, you started to see much more legitimacy granted to this idea of ownership and land ownership and even the homestead, right? The Homestead Act and whiteness protected people. And it provided you a context to go into a local court and say, here's my land, to get somebody who was a geographer who could really say, here's the land, here's where things are. A surveyor who says, hey, your land, Van, ends right here from the west to the east, and this is where it is. And we've been having that for you know, over a century and a half. Black people didn't have that luxury. So even if they had land that they had purchased, a lot of times locally, that purchase was not accepted. Or even if it was accepted in one historical era, in another, when Black people became more vulnerable, it was not accepted. So it became almost impossible to transfer generational wealth. And this is where we get to the heir's property in the Black community. Because, and there's been some great work done on heir's property where you're not able to just say, hey, my son, my daughter, my family is going to get this property. And then legally, anybody who's related to you, this has happened to Prince. There's 100.
Explain them what heir's property is real quick.
Heir's property is the idea that if you don't have a will, and this happened to Prince, Prince left no will. And there are 140 living relatives connected to Prince biologically who then put a claim in on his hundreds of millions of dollars estate. Right. And so basically, if you don't leave a will, anybody who is your biological heir, this can include cousins, it include aunts and uncles, certainly your children can make a claim on the estate and on the property. Right. And that becomes really, really hard to deal with, because unless that group of people are all in together and saying, here's how we're going to divvy this up, what people did with heir's property was they would buy up a share of somebody's claim, right? White folks would buy up a share of somebody's claim and then make a claim to the entire property. So that was one of the ways, but it's many multiple ways, including courthouses that won't accept wills that were drawn up by African-American lawyers. I mean, this is crazy, the way in which the land was taken away, including, you know, the New Deal takes away a lot of Black land, right? The Agricultural Adjustment Act, which is supposed to help white and Black farmers, doesn't give any money to Black farmers and allows white farmers to buy out Black farmers, right? And both the New Deal and even before the New Deal, depressions that happened in the context of World War I and the Great Migration, what white farmers often did was turn Black owners of acres of land into sharecroppers and into debt peonage farmers for them, right? And so this is a combination of racial terror, of the law, of Black people at times leaving land that they owned because they didn't want to die for that land anymore, right? Ta-Nehisi Coates's Case for Reparations gets deeper into this. A great book is Nell Irvin Painter's Exodusters, which looks at the Black folks who Toni Morrison later writes about, Nicodemus, Kansas, from the 1870s and the 1880s, who migrated to get their own community. That's really the first great migration, is a migration out west by African Americans. And then we get the other migration starting really right around World War I out to places like St. Louis and Akron, Ohio, and Cincinnati, and Los Angeles, Oakland. And really, truthfully, Los Angeles, Oakland, we went to them in big ways during the Second World War. And we went to those places because, and that's why you have a Calabama accent, right? Houston, a lot of people from Houston went to Los Angeles. Why? The war is so crazy and there's a manpower shortage, human power shortage. 16 million people are away, and Black folks, including, people don't talk about this often, Black women and men, but women too. There's a Black Rosie the Riveter, called her something else. Not Rosie.
Riveter,
who get jobs in the defense industry, right? So that's what happened. We lost the land out of a combination of physical violence and terror, but also legal chicanery and just plain theft. You know, you see that in the Tremaine Lee essay, and that updates into the 1940s. Black man, very prosperous. He's got a gas station, a store, and he's murdered in broad daylight. He's murdered in broad daylight and never able to pass on that generational wealth to his family.
Dr. Joseph, I recently just learned about my own family that we, on my dad's side, first off, my Lindsay, the name that I have, was changed after their land was taken from them in Louisiana. It's actually Lot. I learned this in the last couple of years, that my great-great-grandfather sent the family off to Texas to defend the land because the KKK was trying to steal it in Louisiana, and they never saw him again. Mm-hmm. So I think if we all trace back, we would probably have a similar story of how land was taken away and wasn't passed on to us. Piggybacking on what Van was talking about the civil rights movement, and you mentioned Black women, and I want to get into that. I think that once I went to college, it changed. But while I was in high school, I don't know. I definitely wasn't taught in my school, but I don't know if I could have named more than five women Black women who were active in the civil rights movement. Yeah. It came on my own, taking certain classes in college, expanding on that curiosity. And I think that most people would be able to relate to that. What I find interesting is in reading your book and then also seeing other things is how Black women were treated in the civil rights movement. Yeah. I was reading something that Barbara Reynolds had said. And if people aren't familiar with her, she's a journalist minister, and her recordings were used in Coretta Scott King's memoir. Mm-hmm. She said there were hundreds of unnamed women who participated in the movement. And she goes on to say, Dr. King was a chauvinist. And she says that men like him, quote, could not assert their manhood in the general society because they would be killed if they stood up for anything. So they asserted their masculinity in other ways within their own community. Dr. Joseph, how true is that?
that's real. That's real. I think it's really complicated. I want to break it down. But Martin Luther King is part of a patriarchal, sexist, we could say misogynoir tradition, both in the Black church and in the Black community. I also think it's very complicated in this sense that when we think about gender and we think about patriarchy, in the Black and white community, people can do multiple things at the same time. They can have multiple identities. So you can have, and just to name some Black women from the civil rights era, because you said five, you know, there's everybody from Mary McLeod Bethune, of course, Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, Angela Davis, but Fran Beal, Gwen Patton. There's so many different Black women throughout the ages, and it's important sort of to remember them. Ruby Doris Smith, so many different Black women who are part of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, part of the Congress of Racial Equality, Sonia Sanchez, it's just a plethora. Artists like Nikki Giovanni, different poets, politicians like Shirley Chisholm, Barbara Jordan. So it's really, with Barbara Reynolds, I'd say that there's really thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of, and millions of Black women who are part of it, you know, like their male counterparts. So the sexism and patriarchy is complicated, and it's there. It's absolutely there. And King is a patriarch. King is what we now call a womanizer, a philanderer. At the same time, people like, I think, Coretta Scott King are not victims. They have agency too, and they're trying to operate within a structure that allows all this stuff to happen, but they want their own dignity. I think Dr. King and Coretta Scott King have a deep, deep love affair, even within the context of that. It's not things that we would accept today, right? Unless people formally, some people say they have open relationships and actually do accept it, right? But it's really complicated. So I want to say, yes, it's there. It's definitely prevalent. But also Black women within that social historical context are pushing back against that, and they have their own agency. So I don't want to put them as victims, but I do think that King and Malcolm and Black men in that historical context, you know, they are both fighting against racism externally, but they're also caught up in this patriarchal a framework of what freedom means. I think Malcolm makes some progress. You know, he goes to Africa. He makes some progress by seeing African revolutionaries alongside Black women and men there. I think King, it's more of a work in progress, because I don't know if King is ever able to, the way Malcolm with the Organization of Afro-American Unity, he has Lynn Shiflett and different Black women, including his sister, Ella Mae Collins, who are his key advisors. And they're in that circle of trust, right? And he's and women who are in the circle of trust, and he doesn't have a romantic relationship with them.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? You know,
yeah. Who
he's just trusting as advisors and as equals. I think over time he gets it. I would never call Malcolm a feminist, but I'm saying he's getting it. He's evolving. He's assassinated at 39, you know? So who knows what he could have become. But I would say that King is more caught up in a chauvinism, a sexism, misogynoir that is just integral to that period. And that's why, look, no woman, no Black woman speaks at the March on Washington, right? 1963. We're about to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington. That's unimaginable now, especially during this recent period where Black women have been, you know, front and center, from Stacey Abrams to Kamala to Andrew Davis, still Tamika Mallory, Alicia Garza, right? You know, so that's what I would say. But I think it's complicated, because I remember talking to a bunch of sisters at the Million Man March. I was 22, and you know, I was talking.
You had some toxic shit to say, didn't you?
Yeah,
you weren't ready for it.
I was talking to them, and I was, you know, we were going back and forth, and at the time, I was in grad school and I was studying this stuff, but there were Black women who, because I read something, a critique by Black feminists of the march, because the march was just men, but there were some women who were at the march. And I said, well, what do you think about this, you know, there's a critique, Angela Davis, other people, bell hooks are saying, this is, you know, sexist, you know, Farrakhan has a real problematic relationship to just a lot of different things, like, you know, what's going on here? And they really push back against the kind of intellectual progressive sort of perspective, in the sense of saying, hey, these brothers need to get their act together. And I'm all for this, right? And I don't think, just because I'm all for this, that somehow I don't have any consciousness. You know what I mean? So yeah. it became something very complicated, where it's not that Black women somehow wanted to be oppressed by Black men within the Nation of Islam or people at the Million Man March, but they felt that they did want to see these Black men who were acting as upstanding leaders. They didn't want to be trampled on or anything, but they felt these Black men needed to handle their business, right? So it's a very complicated thing. And as somebody who grew up in the Black church, I feel the same way. When you're in these grassroots, regular, ordinary, the Black quotidian, it's not quite as cut and dry as when you're in an academic setting and you're saying, hey, here's, you know, here's this very specific argument. You can have a Black woman who's like, no, I'm strong and I'm brilliant, but I do want somebody who is going to be there for me in the context of the family, whatever you academics call that. Do you see what I'm saying? And it doesn't mean you can invalidate my experience, because this is how I want a relationship, right? So it's a really interesting, and that's what I said, it's complicated, right? Because we can hold these ideas, but then how do we actually live our lives?
Right.
So it's
the Sword and the Shield, it's interesting in the way you position this with Dr. King, because you don't really pull any punches about who Dr. King was. But it doesn't seem to be something that weighs the book down or weighs the characterization of Martin Luther King down in any way. It's done very deftly, and it's done with a great degree of nuance. And we don't seem to be able to do that in general society, as far as to have conversations about how women were erased in some of these movements. And at the same time, not diminish the greatness of the men or the figures that came from these movements. It seems like we really struggle with how we're supposed to do that. And Martin Luther King Jr. is a flashpoint of that struggle. He's exemplary of it. It seems difficult to talk about him in any voice other than saintly praise.
Yeah.
And because of that, there's so many lessons from his life that us as Black men can take outside of that it seems like we don't get a chance to actually learn. What do you think about that?
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, King has a relationship with food, with sex, with pleasure that many Black men, I think, struggle with, right? With drinking, you know, like King likes to have a good time. He likes to have a good time, right? And he's struggling with that his whole life, right? And what I mean by food is that King loves some Black food, soul food. He loves food, right? And he struggles with his weight as he gets more stressed. King has sex and likes sex and obviously has that contradiction of liking sex outside of his marriage. That's a big contradiction as a preacher.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Peniel.
Van's face. I'm like, what is so funny to you?
because I said he likes sex.
I don't know what has him so tickled.
Okay.
I mean, that's what he.
And like Dr. King's not supposed to like that. He's like Dr. King.
I have a feeling it's not going to be that funny, Dr. Joseph.
I tried. And then I looked at Rachel, and Rachel caught me. Rachel caught me trying not to laugh. Okay. He just, okay.
Oh, what was the trigger that I said that?
It was just King has sex and likes sex.
Okay. Yeah. Because he does, funny. You know, that's a hard thing for us to come to terms with, right? He likes sex, right? And I think sometimes people will say things like, oh, was Dr. King a sex addict and all these different things? I wouldn't even go that far. I mean, I think he is a celebrity the way in which a lot of folks are celebrities in that time, including President of the United States, President Kennedy, right?
Yeah, of course.
And he's on the road a lot. He's away from his family a lot, right? And so I think within that context, that becomes something he struggles with. Dr. King is a cigarette smoker who smoked cigarettes for his entire life. Most people never see a picture of King with a cigarette. He was deathly afraid of being photographed smoking or anything. Dr. King likes alcohol, right? I don't feel Dr. King was an alcoholic, but at times, especially near the end, they said he started to drink quite a bit. I mean, he was stressed. Who amongst us wouldn't drink if we're constantly facing death penalty, right? And assassination threats, right? So I think finding that out about King, and I talk about the plagiarism charges, makes him more human. And King was hugely brilliant. I think he plagiarizes parts of the dissertation, and that's been proven. But if you read Letter from Birmingham Jail, which is put together from scraps that he writes from jail, King is absolutely brilliant. The only reason why I feel he plagiarized is because he's in a hurry to get the dissertation done. Mm-hmm. He's about to get married. He's about to start a new job, and he becomes really sloppy and just takes these shortcuts. I think all these things make him much more human. And as a Black man, he struggles with ideas of masculinity. And you can see it in The Sword and the Shield when at times he's extremely angry with what Malcolm X is saying. He's so angry that by May of 1963, after Malcolm is calling him anything but a child of God after Birmingham, saying that he's a coward, he's this, he's at a huge rally, 35,000 people in Los Angeles, and he's talking to Malcolm without ever saying it. Sammy Davis Jr. is there, everybody's there. And what he says is that nonviolence is a tool of people who are powerful, who are courageous, who are muscular. And then he says, it's the cowards who won't embrace nonviolence. He's talking about Malcolm X. He's talking about Malcolm X. He's saying, you're the coward. I'm not the coward. I mean, and King practically wants to say, you know, MF to this guy. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, so King is like us. Like, he's just more disciplined publicly, right? But King, I mean, there's parts of King that wants to get in a fist fight with Malcolm.
Yeah, rubbing my fade, Malcolm. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, who are you? Who are you to challenge me with everything that I'm going through? So he really teaches us a whole lot about being, you know, trying to be a complicated Black man who is not oppressing Black women, who's not mistreating your children. King never hits his children. You know, that stops the cycle because he was hit by Daddy King, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and as somebody, I grew up in a Black household where I was hit. I'm stopping the cycle with my daughter right now. You know, I was hit, right? So I think King is really important for us about in terms of Black masculinity. And Malcolm, too, but in a different way. You know, Malcolm, too, in a different way.
I am curious if a conversation was ever had publicly where there was some acknowledgement from the men and black men in the civil rights movement of how they weren't treating the women in the same way. And I say this because it's obvious at this point that we know now that the civil rights movement could not have happened without women. They were organizers. They were educators. They were strategists. They were writers. They were heavily involved. I mean, Dorothy Hite, shout out to Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated. I mean, she was on stage at the March, Van Stoff. She was on stage at the March on Washington. And the Civil Rights Act in 1964, which I think sometimes people forget about, did not include sex. It didn't originally include gender. Yeah. That didn't come till later, which also shows that women were placed on the back burner. And I'm just curious if there was, because I read something where James Farmer has talked about later in life about how, about Dorothy Hite and spoke towards that and how she often wasn't interviewed by the press because of sexism. But were there any men that were speaking up and saying, no, we gotta, you know, like we gotta include the women. We gotta give them leadership roles in these organizations. We gotta make them the face of some of this. Was there any of that?
Well, I think that there's going to be some in activist organizations, certainly like SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And there were black women like Gloria Richardson and the Fran Beals and the Gwen Pattons, who are leaders in SNCC, Ruby Doris Smith Robinson. So, yes, I think there were. I think they weren't happening enough at the national level, because by the time you get to the national level, groups like the Congressional Black Caucus and a guy like Jesse Jackson, they thought, for instance, when Shirley Chisholm ran, that it wasn't going to be good if it wasn't a black man to run. So in the context of the 1970s, says, look, we still don't have a woman president. We still have never had a woman president in the United States. So it was perceived as weakness. And part of that has to do with the fact that the freedom dreams of the black freedom struggle have always contained a tension where they run along multiple tracks. One track interprets freedom as a kind of black male patriarchy that mirrors white male patriarchy, with black men in an unfettered way having the prerogatives of white male patriarchy. So we become the new capitalist, the head of the household. In a way, the Nation of Islam, for all of its radicalism, and there are aspects of it that are radical and militant, is quite conservative in wanting that kind of small, petty bourgeois, black male, patriarchal capitalism. There's no room for people who are queer. There's no room for women's leadership other than the way in which the box that black men might be putting them in. That's one version. Another version is a very expansive version of black women as co-architects. And you can see that with Ida B. Wells, Anna Julia Cooper, Frances Harper, Mariah Stewart, Nanny Helen Burroughs, certainly Dorothy Hite, Mary McLeod Bethune, just so many different others, right? And so that's a huge tension, and that tension continues to this day, right? It's just that in recently, because of people like Michelle Obama and Black Lives Matter, for the first time in American history, we've seen black women who are fully acknowledged as leaders and architects of the freedom struggle, in addition to being individual, you know, talented artists and creators and activists, right? So you've seen more light on black women right at this moment in American history than ever before. And data-wise, we have more black women than men because of structural racism, graduating from high school, graduating from college, getting master's degrees, getting PhDs, going to medical school, and really being successful. You know what I mean? Like, there's more black women at UT than black men at UT, right? We might look at it and think differently because you think about the football team at UT or the basketball team at UT. But black women are finding much more success in higher education, much more success in corporate America. Guess what, Rachel? The first two black people to ever become presidents of Ivy League universities, Brown University, and now it's going to be Harvard, is Ruth Simmons at Brown, Ruth Simmons, who is now retiring at PVMU and coming to Rice, and now Claudine Gay, Haitian sister, shout out to Claudine Gay. And that shows you the difference, right? it's unimaginable that if we think about the second Reconstruction or the 1980s or 1990s, if they were going to, the first Black president of Ivy League would have been a Black woman. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Now, Harvard's first Black president is not Barack Obama, it's Claudine Gay, right? And so it's showing you something about the valence and the leadership, the stature of Black women in American culture that didn't exist before. You know what I mean? When you just see mm-hmm. it. So it's really there. And I think even still though, within our community, there's tensions about what does that mean? And how do we both, in terms of if you're an ambitious Black woman, ambitious Black man, be on the same team? And I'm not talking about romantically, I'm just saying on the same team, because there's really competition, right? You know what I mean? Like, because we all know we live in a capitalist society. There aren't slots for everybody.
Yeah.
You ain't all going to be president of Harvard, or everybody's not going to have a nationally broadcast podcast. You know what I mean? Right.
Yeah.
So now we really are in a kind of tension, but we can also be in solidarity with each other, which is the better route, I would argue.
Give them a book. Give them a book. We're going to start doing this. Peniel Joseph's Book of the Month. You must read this book, okay? Wherever the book is, it could be one of your books, Peniel. It could be a different book. We'll give them a book. Give them a book to read. Do it now.
You know, I love a couple of books. Dante Stewart's Shouting in the Fire, an American epistle. And it's on religion. Dante is somebody to have on the show. He's a former Clemson University athlete turned writer, Black Pentecostal who went through the white evangelical church and is now out.
Oh, yeah.
Radical Black figure who talks about anxiety, depression, talks about trauma and grief. Really brilliant brother. We just had him at University of Texas down here and he just lit it up. Dante Stewart, Shouting in the Fire. Is one that's really brilliant.
Just one.
Just one. Okay.
Don't weigh him down, Peniel. Okay. Hold on. Shout in the fire. Don't weigh him down, Peniel. We'll bring you back on. We'll bring you on and we'll do Peniel Joseph's Book of the Month. Shout in the fire.
That book should be a bestseller. That is an unbelievable book.
Yeah. Unbelievable. And what did you say? What did you say Dr. King liked? What did you say? Never mind. Okay. Guys, that is that's Peniel Joseph. Look, the erasure of Black women in these movements will not continue. It's important to know how integral we've been together as allies culturally, Black men and Black women. Okay, it's very important. It's very important. Peniel Joseph. From the University of Texas, LBJ School of Hard Knocks. We appreciate you coming back on Higher Learning, bro. Book of the Month. Every single month, we're going to give them Peniel Joseph's Book of the Month. We need to do this. Right. And then at the end, well, it's the second month, so at the end of the end of the year, we'll round them all up.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, brother. Thank you for joining us, man.
Thank you, as always.
Thank you, Rachel.
Okay. Peniel Joseph, genius.
I know. So good. Those students are so lucky to have him. Are you serious?
Yeah, maybe they are.
Maybe they are.
Maybe I should be teaching them. Who knows? I could teach them all kinds of things. I could teach a Marvel class at the LBJ school. I could teach a class.
Well, that's a public policy school, so no. You wouldn't be.
I could do nothing. Peniel Joseph is the man.
You could literally teach a Marvel class though.
An intellectual hero. Actually, no. Do you know how many people out there that know so much more about Marvel than me?
Really?
Oh my God. Whatever. All right. Speaking of powerful messages, I would like to hear a powerful message from the White House about what's going on in our skies. Okay. I'm not sure what's happening.
I'm good.
You don't care?
No, I care. I find it terrifying. And I would just rather be ignorant. I'm not in a rush. Please don't. No, I care a lot.
Okay. The U.S. has shot down four objects in 8 days. This is since the Chinese spy balloon situation, if you know, four of the objects that have been shot down, just unprecedented in peacetime, people say. Lake Huron shot down an unidentified object. Okay. Canada, unidentified object. Joe Biden ordered these things to be shot down. What are you shooting? What are you spraying around? You just cut one?
Copper keeps passing gas.
Oh, copper farted. Do you do that thing to where, do you get gassy? Is that a thing with you?
All the time.
You do? So
I'm a gassy person. I'm very open about this.
Okay. So you're gassy and then you spray that. So how do you know when it's you or when it's copper?
Okay. I always can tell when it's me. I can feel it leaving my body.
Sometimes it happens to me and I don't know.
That's not me. I'm not loose like that. Copper, on the other hand, it's the medicine that he's taking, and it is just foul.
Just gets it, right? It's random.
Yeah.
Okay, so part of the reason for these shootdowns is a heightened alert that we're under following the spy balloon that got shot down. This is according to General Glenn Van Hert, who's the head of NORAD. And the U.S. Northern Command. He said this in a briefing with reporters. Since then, there have been fighter jets that have been all over the place, and they've shot down stuff over Canada, Alaska. Pentagon officials have said that they pose no security threats, but so little was known about them that the Pentagon officials were ruling nothing out, including UFOs. Okay. This is a frustrating situation for me for many reasons.
Okay.
I don't feel that we're getting the transparency that we should be getting from the government on this.
What are you expecting them to tell you?
I'm expecting, look, I understand that the situation is still pretty fluid. But they've shot the stuff down and they know what was shot down.
Right. I don't think they know. They know not to call them balloons. They're calling them objects specifically, and they're not ruling out the fact that it could be something extraterrestrial. I honestly, Van, that's enough for me. They don't even know how they're flying. That has also been revealed. They cannot figure out how the things are flying. I'm out.
So one of the objects shot down was cylindrical and silverish gray with no identifiable propulsion system. Another was shot down. Small, cylindrical object. The third was an octagonal structure with strings.
I'm good.
I feel like they know more here. I feel like they know more here. I don't. This is where I get into my tinfoil hatchet. I feel like they know more here. I feel like there's something to be known. Look, this could be the beginning of sort of
the end.
Well, no, I would say some escalating tensions between the United States and China or other people.
Or Russia.
I read about different spy planes that we've had. And the United States' rush to invent technology and spy planes that are capable of flying so high that it's very difficult to shoot them down. But even though we've had these planes, different types of spy bombers and all of this stuff, fly super high, almost the fucking space guys are wearing like oxygen masks and stuff to fly the planes. Some of them have still been shot at and shot down. So nations spying on each other and using surveillance methods, be them drones, planes, whatever they are, that is a tale as old as time. There's nothing new about that. This right here is peculiar in the frequency and in the short time in which this has happened. And also the relative caginess from government officials on this. And it's even more scary if the shit, they have it and they don't know what it is. Because guess what? They're supposed to know what it is.
Well, if it's something that they've never seen before, they might not know. I think you're wanting to hear something from them that they really can't give you. And I don't think because this is something unprecedented, they're even saying that, they want to be matter of fact when they tell you and not cause public outrage, like just a full out scare from the public. I'm already scared. And I think them not knowing, because that's what I really think it is, and them not knowing, like it not being matter of fact, is even more terrifying to me. That's what I think it is.
If you don't know what it is, how do you even know that you should shoot it down? If you don't know,
you should just, because it was in the pathway of commercial planes.
Okay, like cool. It was in the pathway. So all of them were in the pathway of commercial planes because one of them was in fucking Alaska.
Canada actually asked for them to shoot that one down, I believe.
Okay, so what I'm saying is that they at least know that they pose some sort of threat. The commercial planes point is a fair point, but and I've read a fair degree about this. There seems to be an awakening that's happened since the spy balloon situation, and perhaps there are more surveillance objects over U.S. airspace and Canadian airspace than they thought that there were. And for some reason, they don't either don't recognize these objects or they don't want to tell us that the Chinese are looking as hard as what they are or some other nation is looking as hard as what they are. But as fast as we've learned about all of these different incidents, you'd think that there would be a very substantive briefing to the American people about what's going on here. That, look, it could be some alien shit.
Today they gave us nothing. They had a briefing today, nothing.
Donnie, what do you think?
I'm a believer. I think that I think it's aliens. I'm like halfway
into... You sound excited, Donnie.
Think you're a fucking freak.
It sounds crazy, but I don't know. It's like I'm in an alien mindset when it comes to, I think, like right now I'm halfway through the first season of X-Files. So I'm like, this is the timeliness of this.
Speaking Jesus of, Christ.
Like, it feels
Ashley,
like...
Ashley, yes. It's real. What do you think?
I mean,
Donnie's excited over there.
I think it's terrifying if it is aliens. The government lies about lots of stuff, so why wouldn't it be aliens? You know what I mean? Why would, or it's something even worse. It's like a country doing some weird stuff. So I don't know.
I mean, what would you rather?
Is that
your serious question, Van? Would you rather it be some spy intelligence or extraterrestrial activity?
Well, This is the thing that I believe about aliens fundamentally, right? I believe that if the aliens are coming here, there's just no good reason for them to come here.
Yes, it's not curiosity.
Hawking said that the aliens would come within 150 years or something like that. And he said if they did come, then the odds are that they were nomadic killer aliens that had exhausted all the resources on their planet. And they were looking for a new planet to take all the resources from because it's a very long way to travel. Okay. Now, that is very terrifying. Stephen Hawking. Rest in peace, Hawk. Like, it is very terrifying. I tend to believe there are other people who think it's different, right? Other people who think it's maybe not saying it enough. People who think it's not who they might come here and be nice and, you know what I'm saying? Start sharing candy and like going, you know, whatever. But that's very scary, obviously, because we'd be dealing with the technology and the civilization that we can't really match wits with if they're coming from that far away. If it's spy stuff, it's not that big of a deal to me. We spy on them, they spy on us. This is the deal. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we might not send...
This is the deal.
We might not send balloons over them, but we had definitely, during the Cold War and at other times, have had planes flying around taking pictures of people. It's kind of a deal. You know what I mean? So, hold on. The White House did say this today, though. There's, again, no indication of aliens or extraterrestrial activity with these recent takedowns. This just came up. It says John Kirby, who's a spokesperson for the National Security Council, said that all manners of innocuous craft can fly at the same altitudes. That includes aircraft used by companies or countries for purposes that are not nefarious at all. And they said that all of these were determined not to pose a direct threat to people on the ground. They were also found to be uncrewed and have limited abilities, from a lack of communication signals to a lack of obvious propulsion capability. So these seem to be things that were floating around, doing different stuff. So it doesn't seem to be aliens. Donnie, you fucking freak. Okay. It's probably the fact that we are now on the lookout for these things since the spy balloon. And because we're on the lookout for them, we are finding them. Okay. One more time. We're not going to do the DDG versus Ruby Rose versus Halle Bailey thing because it's just too much. But I do want to talk about this Idris Elba situation.
Are they your friends?
I don't know any of them. They're just kids, man. They're like some babies. Ruby Rose. I don't even know. I know who Ruby Rose is because, you know. But, like, I don't even know who DDG is. I don't know who that is.
You don't know who DDG is? You've never seen him with Halle?
I know that he's with Halle, but I don't know what, like, DDG does. Is DDG a rapper?
He's big on social. He is a rapper. He's very big on social media, but more on YouTube. Like, his whole family does stuff, and he's got this really funny nephew called Woo Wop. And did you ever see he had this viral moment, the little nephew? He's a really funny kid. And his dad or somebody dressed him up as like an emo kid. And when they took off his like veil or whatever, he had like spikes on his necklace and like all these, it just, he was emo. And he started singing the song, "I want to kill my mom, I want to kill my dad." And like he stood in front of a room of like Black people and they were like, "What the fuck?" And no. He was like, I'm going to say it to you. Anyways, Woo-Wop is hilarious. He's hilarious. Hilarious. Right. So that's how I got to know who DDG is because of Woo-Wop.
All right. So they're all going back and forth. It seems like Ruby Rose and DDG or whatever, and Halle's in the middle of it, whatever. It's really kid stuff. I really don't know what's going on.
No, I don't want to get into it.
Idris Elba, though, he says that he stopped describing himself as a Black actor because it puts himself in a box, puts him in a box. He opened up about race and nationality in a new cover with Esquire magazine. Says, "Didn't become an actor because I didn't see Black people doing it and I want to change that." What? "I did it because I thought that's a great profession and I could do a good job at it. As you get up the ladder, you get asked what it's like to be the first Black to do this or that. Well, it's the same as it would be if I were white. It's the first time for me. I don't want to be the first Black. I'm the first Idris. Stop describing myself as a Black actor when I realize it put me in a box. You've got to grow. You've got to. Our skin is no more than that. It's just skin." Rant over. Okay, since then, Idris Elba has come out and said that he identifies himself as nothing more than a strong Black man. He's a man. He's a strong Black man. He understands what it's like to be a Black man. However, as an actor, which is his profession, as John Boyega came out, shout out to John Boyega. John Boyega came out and challenged Idris Elba on this. And Idris Elba said, "You know, look, I'm a Black man, but as an actor, doesn't think the Black thing is necessary." Rach?
I mean, what else are you as an actor?
What do you mean, what else is he? He's an actor. He's fucking Luther.
Okay, but that's what I'm saying. But every time you step into one of these roles, you're a Black man in these roles. Do you know what I'm saying? So it doesn't make sense for him to say, "Don't put me in a box." When we look at you on the screen, we see you as a Black man. When you play Luther, you're a Black man. I don't understand. I understand what he's saying, but I also don't understand what he's saying. Do you see what I'm saying? Yeah. You might want people to see you just as an actor, but they will always see you by your color first. And if you do identify yourself as a Black man, then you know walking through this earth as a Black man, that is the first thing that people see about you. Maybe he's saying he doesn't want it to be so much of a conversation because everybody has been speculating whether or not he's going to be the next James Bond. And if so, he would be the Black James Bond. And so maybe he's saying, "I'm tired of that conversation surrounding it." But like, if you're the first Black James Bond, you should also understand what representation means and how important that could be for people who grew up watching James Bond, who are fans of it, to now see a Black man step in that role and be as, I've never seen a James Bond movie, but to step in that role and be cool, calm, and collected as James Bond comes off being, see a Black man do that, that might be powerful to some Black people for representation's sake. So I don't really understand. I don't understand where Idris was going with this. I really don't. Or why he felt the need to do this.
So there's a fork in the road here. There's like a split.
For you?
Yeah. No, I just think, period.
Okay.
It's important to talk about. Okay. I don't look at Black as an individual characteristic. And I think that might be what separates the two methods of thought. Black to me is not an individual characteristic. You know, I have scaly feet from basketball. You know, my feet are all, my heels are all messed up. My toes are messed up from all the time I put it on the court, hoping, getting buckets. Okay, that's an individual characteristic. Something that other people might have, but that's something that I've done to myself. Black, to me, my Black is not just who I am. It's the culmination of who millions of people have been. And I know that that sounds like bullshit. I know that that sounds like an impossible burden. And I know that that sounds like something that's unfair. But to me, it's insanely liberating. And not just liberating, it's empowering to know that my life represents something, that my life is a part of something. My life means something in terms of a culture that is a lot bigger than me. So if I were to ever become the first Black whatever, that wouldn't be something that would be for me. That would be something that would be for us. That would be something that would be meaningful to people who have survived and persevered under these really crazy odds. And so there's something that's missed when you take this huge cultural situation and you shrink it down. Now, I understand for his life, that's fine. He wants to be, he doesn't want that whole thing. He doesn't think that that's a part of it. Like when he acts or goes somewhere, he wants to be free from that. To me, it's not a burden or an albatross. It actually is part of what gives me my wings. Is the fact that so many other people, women and men, have really had to put on for me to be in this situation. And you know what the funny thing about it is? The funny thing about it is we understand that, or they want us to understand that, with everything except for our Blackness, right? Everything except for our Blackness they want us to get, right? So if we're watching the Olympics, they want you to care about the medal count of America. They want you to care when somebody is waving an American flag. They want you to go somewhere and be an American. You know what I mean? They want you to go somewhere and be a representative of a country or a culture. They want you to feel that that's important. And if you're not a patriot, then they tell you that's bad. They say, hey, not caring about all of the people that came before and the total cultural weight of where it is that you are from. So they want that to mean something to you. Because that's the thing that makes you go fight somebody and kill someone. That's the thing that makes you go spy on someone. That's the thing that makes you sacrifice. Right. That's the thing that makes you do a little bit less for yourself so that you can do it for everybody else, the fact that you care about being in America. But when it's about being Black, they don't want you to care about that. They didn't want you to take all of the incredible sacrifices that people have made in the diaspora worldwide, because Idris Elba is not a Black American. And so there are things that here, let's just keep it all the way gangster, there are things that we would get or feel the need to identify with here that he might not because he's not a Black American. But still, in terms of the diaspora, the worldwide Black struggle, there should certainly be things that Idris Elba understands about the struggle of being Black. But when it comes to that, they want you to forget it and be like, hey, I'm not this thing. I am Black. I am British. I am Idris. My Blackness has nothing to do. My Blackness doesn't give me the strength or the poise that I might need to deliver this role. My Blackness doesn't give me the focus. You know what I mean? There's no part of me. I would say that as an artist, it would be important to understand how your cultural background, your heritage, the strength and the clarity of that cultural understanding informs your artistry. That's what I hear when I hear Bob Marley. That's what I hear when I hear Stevie Wonder, when I hear Muddy Waters. That's what I hear when I hear Bono. You know what I'm saying? That's what I hear when I hear the Cranberries. That's what I hear when I hear the Beatles. When I hear all of these different people, when I see all of these different people acting and doing their things and creating music and art, I hear the power of their culture, who they are and what they are, informing their art and making it better.
Yeah.
And I'm not offended by what Idris Elba says. So I'm working very hard to be less offended. But I'm just looking at it like, why is being Black, the first Black, the Black this, the Black that, not an intense sense of pride? Why does it have to be something that, what's wrong with that? Just because you're the first Black don't mean you can't be the other. Barack Obama is the first Black president. He's a good president. You know what I mean? It's like, just because, that doesn't mean that that's all you have to be. Why is it happening? Like, what? And look, if he doesn't feel that way, he doesn't feel that way. But I don't want there to be this misunderstanding that we don't bring that shit with us. And we need to remember and be a part of. You know what I'm saying? So it's just, I don't know.
I just don't like the public announcement behind it. It's like, why? I don't know what question was posed to him, but I don't understand why you felt like you needed to give that response. So I'm not offended, but I do think that what he's saying is problematic, because this is where you take that type of quote, where you see the other side take this quote and say, see, this is how Idris thinks. Why don't the rest of y'all think like that? Why can't we all just put our color to the side?
I mean, look, I'll be real with you. If I wanted to be a cynic and an asshole about it, the thought would be maybe he wants people to know that he feels that way, and he thinks that that would help him get the James Bond role. You know what I mean? But I don't think that's... I've never seen Idris Elba be anything other than a really stand-up, amazing guy who represents various parts of where he's from. His African roots, we've seen him really embrace. Obviously, he's a proud Englishman. And when he's come over here, he's been one of us. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's like, I just don't think that it's necessary for you to stand there all dripped in chocolate and just tell people you're not Black. You know what I'm saying? It's like, or to tell you just... Come on, man. All right. I just don't know what this is.
I don't either.
It's like, all right, cool. Cool. Hey.
No, it's not cool. It's just, look, I don't want...
Whatever niggas be on is what they be on, man. But come on, goddammit, man. You don't want to be Black. This is the fucking shit. You don't want to be Black. Think about it. You gotta want to be. I'm not even talking about as a man, because he said he's a proud Black man. I'm talking about as a Black actor.
Yeah, think about what that represents.
You don't want to be with Denzel and Angela Bassett, huh? You don't want to be with motherfucking Chiwetel. You don't want to be. You don't want to be with Michael B. Jordan. You don't want to be with Sidney Poitier. You don't want to be with Cicely Tyson. You don't want to be with motherfucking Bill Duke. You don't want to be with Lawrence Fishburne, huh?
But you've done so many Black things.
You've done Eddie Murphy. You don't want to be with them.
You've done The Wire. You've done Tyler Perry movie. A movie like that's so Black.
Little Girl.
So Black. It's so Black.
You know what's crazy?
It makes you feel like you reached a certain level. Now you don't want to.
No, it's just crazy though, because they would have never put Justin Timberlake in Daddy's Little Girls. And Justin Timberlake would have never been Stringer Bell. You got those because you black. Okay, listen. I love Idris Elba. I hope he's fine. You know, just come on, guys. Let's, you know, man. You know, come on. Woo-hoo. You know what I mean? Come on, guys. Don't do us like that. Bubby.
Van Series question of the week. Is Idris Elba black?
Shut up. Guys, don't do it. Just like, you know, that's like not to Esquire. You know, if you're in the room.
Don't do it at all. No,
Wait. That's like, if you're in the room and it's you and Spielberg and the rest of them, and you feel like you got to get your shit off that way, nigga, I'm not even going to fucking, it's not for me, but I'm not even going to trip. It's not to Esquire, though. Because the writers of Esquire are like, ooh, interesting. And of course, they're going to leak the nigga shit. Anyway, Idris will be Bond. I love Idris Elba. Just, we all got to continue to learn and continue to grow. So. All right, take the theme caps off and do not stop learning. I'm Van Lathan Jr.
I am Rachel Lynn Lindsay. Bye, guys.
Vanessa Joseph.